This podcast was recorded on Kaurna land. We acknowledge the Kaurna people as the original custodians of the land and pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples.
You'll want to make a note.
Should you be taking notes or something?
You got a pencil? Write this down, quick.
Why aren't you taking notes?
Write this down.
Aren't you going to write this down?
Did you need me to take notes?
Please take note.
Everyone, and welcome to our very first live episode of Take Note. We are so excited to be bringing you this episode. We've got some wonderful people in the room joining us, but we also have some lovely people online. It's so exciting to be able to bring this to you in all formats. Don't really know where to look. It's got people everywhere. But thank you so much again for coming. We have some really exciting guests today. So we'd like to welcome Dr. Nikki Sullivan, who is a project development manager at Thorn Harbour Health, but she's also an adjunct professor at the School of Humanities at our university here at the University of Adelaide, which is great. We've also got Sarah Childs here, who is a sexologist and has a background in LGBT focused areas as well. So it's super exciting. Thank you guys so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having us.
I'm so excited to get into the chat today. Mm-hmm. So we might start with, what are some of the common challenges people have when it comes to sex in relationships?
That's a really good question. Where do we start? Because lots of people have lots of different questions when it comes to sexual health. What do you see?
Yeah, Nikki? I think, look, I mean, we do sexual health promotion, and so I'm not a client-facing person who, you know, counsels people on their sexual health problems. But I think, you know, some of the biggest questions are around, what is safe sex? What is respectful sex? You know, what is consent? Why do all of those things matter? And yeah, I guess we're a sex positive organization that wants to help people to have positive experiences of sex.
Mm-hmm. Just to add on to the consent, one thing that I do see, because I do have client-facing aspects to my role, so I'll just explain my role a little bit. I have a background in education. So I call myself a sexologist or a sex educator. So I go into schools and talk about diversity. Particularly my passions areas are in LGBT space and health. And I work with younger people when I do that. So I go into high schools and primary schools. And one of the biggest things that I find from them is just worried about being normal. And another thing is advocating. This is for younger adults more. So when I see them one-on-one, how to ask for the pleasure that they want is a really tricky question to get to. So, yeah, that's a big thing.
Yeah, so how would you, I guess, approach that if someone's saying, you know, I'm not really in the sexual relationship that I'd like to be in with my partner, how can I best communicate that? What kind of advice would you be giving in those scenarios?
That's a really good question. I would be... Sorry, I'm a little nervous. Can you repeat that again?
Absolutely. So if someone is sort of feeling like they're not getting the kind of sex that they want maybe in their relationship, but they a bit unsure about how to communicate with that partner, what kinds of advice would you give someone?
Oh, absolutely. So I would be when I work one-on-one with people, we establish what their communication style is with their partner already and how they communicate their needs in other needs other than sexual areas. How do you talk to your partner about what you want in the fridge or something like that? Start basic. And then, you know, slowly introduce those topics as they come up. Just easing into the conversation, talking about what you do feel comfortable enough and making that transition enough over to what you feel comfortable about.
Yeah, and I guess building on from that, I think we talk about a lot about sexual compatibility when we're sort of figuring out partners and things like that. But I guess for people that work in the industry with people, what do you think it really means to be sexually compatible with someone?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it means that you have a respectful relationship, whatever that means, whatever you mean by relationship. but you have a relationship whereby you can speak to each other about, well, look, this is what I would like to do, or this is where I won't go, or I think it's hard to know who you're compatible with sexually unless you've tried absolutely everything there is to try. So I think in large part sex is about experimentation. But it's really important that whomever you're experimenting with, you're doing that safely and respectfully, and they respect your boundaries and they respect your right to say no at any point. I guess those are the things that I would be focusing on.
I agree. Sorry.
Yeah, and I guess, is it something that we should say, things are really good, we're loving life, but, we might be with our partner for a long time. Is that something we should expect to stay the same all the time, or is that something we should expect to sort of change as different things happen through life?
Well, absolutely. I think one thing that is consistent in our lives is change. The only thing that is constant is change. And sometimes partners do get stuck in a rut, and it is hard to force that change. But taking a partner into new spaces, and beginning these conversations. So maybe, going out for a picnic, that's different from what you usually do in your relationship. So maybe starting doing activities that are a little bit weird for you guys, and then starting to introduce that into the bedroom. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is there a connection, do you feel, between sort of cultivating healthy relationships with our sexual partners and then that translating into good sex?
Well, I would think so. I think it's very difficult to have good sex unless there's some sort of sense of trust. And it may be that you've only just met somebody so that, building trust has not happened to any great extent. But, you might be having sex with that person in a place where you assume that they know what the rules of the space are. And so, I think that's what matters, is that there's a sense of reciprocity, that you come together with the same sets of values, even if you haven't had a huge amount of opportunity to talk those through, that, you can get a sense usually quite quickly of whether or not somebody's on the same sort of wavelength as you are. And I guess, if you're mindful about having sex safely, then you tend to avoid putting yourself in situations where you are vulnerable and you don't know anybody, or things could go horribly wrong.
What I would add to that is that is a big red flag if you don't feel safe with somebody. If, for example, you're having a casual hook up with somebody and they don't want to put on a condom or choose safer sex options, then they would be big red flags for you to think about, do you trust this person? And I know, in previous experiences of my own and of my clients, that can be really tricky, especially your target audience, you guys being university students. It's really hard. Sometimes you feel like you're being pressured or things like that to get into thinking about strategies and using your support networks, your uni friends, the counselling service to make sure that you have safer sexual experiences, and maybe practicing these dialogues in those situations with your friends and counselling services. I would highly recommend that.
I think that's a great idea, to practice with your friends. And I think, to try to build within yourself a sense of yourself as somebody who has a right to determine what happens with your body at any point in any encounter. It's your decision, and we shouldn't ever feel like, oh, I don't want to upset the other person. You have to decide what is right for you, and if they are somebody that you want to have any kind of a relationship with moving forward, they have to be somebody who respects that.
Yeah, and I love that, because I feel like it's a lot about advocating for yourself, but I know that that's not the easiest thing for every person. Maybe someone's a bit of a people pleaser, maybe they've been brought up in a way where they're sort of expected to do the right thing at the right time. So how can you sort of, work through that to be able to be that assertive person you need to be for yourself in those sort of situations?
Well, picking up on what you said and what I said from before, it might sound weird, but practice. So practicing this, if you have a therapy, if you're lucky enough to have a therapy space, I know that can be difficult to access, but I know UniSA have great counselling services here. Or if you have a supported friend, you could bring up those conversations. You can see Shine or Thorn Hub Health or somebody like me, and we can practice those conversations in a welcoming and open free space. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you might also be a member of, you know, a sort of a grassroots political group on campus where, you know, when I was a young woman and, you know, an early second wave feminist, we were very much talking about that kind of stuff. Because it is really, it's a political issue. It's not just a personal issue. It's something that we actually have a responsibility for, I believe, to look after ourselves, but also to create sort of norms around sex that ensure that other people are safe as well.
Absolutely, and you might, like building on that, your friends might have not have, I mean, it might be a bit weird to start this conversation, like let's practice, for example, this is very heteronormative in my brain, but I want to sleep with a guy and I'm nervous about asking him to put on a condom. Can we like practice some scenarios together just as friends? And your friends may not have thought of that, and that's a learning experience in themselves for them as well, so that they, even though they didn't ask the question, they're prepared to ask that question when they had that experience as well.
And you can end up having lots of fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I like that as well, because it's also normalizing the conversation about these types of things within your friend group. And I think the more you talk about these types of topics, the more empowered you naturally become to advocate for yourself and sort of, I guess, think about how to stand up for yourself in those scenarios and about what you want and all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And as you're saying, you know, healthy relationships do sort of have that link within good sex and all that kind of stuff. So I guess what's on your advice on ways to build that healthy, strong relationship so that it does translate into that sort of connection in the bedroom?
Well, I would, again, going back to the condom example, make sure that we have that strong foundation of trust, because every relationship has that trust element. And if you feel like you can't, for example, trust a long-term partner with telling them the whole truth or what you're doing on the weekend, is that really a relationship that you want to build? Is that a relationship built on trust? So that's my initial response to the question.
I guess what I want to say in response to that is that I think lots of sex takes place outside of relationships and or outside of sort of long-term or sort of, you know, monogamous relationships. And so I think there's a whole range of strategies for negotiating that you can learn in casual sexual encounters that actually can really help your relationship. So I'm kind of thinking about it the other way around. If you can negotiate with people you don't know very well, you're more likely, I think, to be able to then take those skills into something that is more long-term or...
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've all heard the terms turn on and turn offs, but could you give us a little bit of an understanding maybe of what that might mean in a sexual context?
Well, I guess, you know, when you talked about the red flag, so for me, red flags are turn offs. Mm-hmm. They're that moment when the other person does or says something where you go, oh, hang on, we're not on the same wavelength here. And, you know, you all of a sudden don't want to continue with whatever it was that you were doing. And I think it's really important to listen to yourself. I think that often young people, well, I can only speak about when I was a young person a very long time ago, but, you know, I often didn't feel like I had the confidence to say, you know what, I'm not feeling comfortable, so let's just stop and have a chat or whatever it is. You'd kind of be like, oh, okay, maybe I'll just do it and go along with it and get over and done with. And I think that, yeah, what I would try to encourage in everyone is to develop that capacity to listen to yourself and know when or it's not working for you.
And building on the flip side of that, I think the intuition is a huge key to it. And when it comes to turn-ons, when your intuition is telling you that feels exciting, I want to do that, that is a huge expression of what you want and what your turn-on is and things like that. So using your intuition to build on what Nikki was saying.
Yeah, and in that sense, not being, you know, trying to develop strategies that stop you not doing things you want to do because you think other people might think that that's weird, or, you know, that's not okay. Actually, you have to develop your own set of, you know, ideals, I guess, around what is works for you. And it may be that, you know, your dad doesn't think that something in particular is okay, but it's not your dad's choice here, it's yours.
Yes, yeah, it's your choice. And there are spaces around those where you can find those spaces to express yourself. So, for example, if you're into kink or leather or things like that, there's communities here in Adelaide and online spaces where you can find those places where people will be accepting. Because the leather, for example, to use your example, the leather isn't for your dad, it's for you, and that's a private part of your life, and you can explore that in those safe spaces.
Yeah, and I feel like what you're getting at is that they're not just this physical thing, which I think a lot of us think of as, you know, oh, I don't like someone with this type of beard, or, like, you know, this colour eyes, or something really kind of, I guess, arbitrary. And it sounds like they are sort of, I guess, a bit more, like, emotional or maybe even contextual. So, like, why does those sort of environments matter so much to your experience when it comes to having a sexual encounter?
Well, I think, you know, often you... when you're around other people, like, just say there is a particular look that you're drawn to, or a particular way of dressing that you're drawn to, when you find yourself amongst those people, you feel at home, you feel comfortable, you know, you might well find you've got things in common. Whereas, you know, if you went somewhere else where people were really different to you in a way that didn't really speak to you, then you're far less likely to feel safe, to feel at home, to feel like you fit in. I think, you know, we're all always trying to find our safe spaces in the world, aren't we? And like you say, we've got so many more options now because we've got online spaces as well as in-person spaces. Although I do think there are some things to remember about online encounters too, that probably worth talking about at some point.
Absolutely. I was going, as soon as I said, talked about it, I was like, make sure you're protecting yourself, particularly in the online space, because there are nefarious actors and there are people in your real life that might shame you for these things because they don't completely understand. So making sure you're protecting yourself is a huge thing. I know that wasn't completely answered to your question, but I really do want to make sure that that is heard by our audience. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's definitely something I think I've experienced. I've read books about this type of topic before, and one of them was saying, think about, like, the best sex you've had and what was the surroundings of that. You know, what did the room look like? What kind of things had just happened in your day? What was the, you know, how were you feeling in the moment? What was happening with the relationship? And I feel like that was such, like, a light bulb moment for me, knowing that that stuff has such an impact, because I think it's something we just don't think about at all. We go, why wasn't that great? And it's like, well, that's because I felt kind of crap and, you know, I didn't sleep well, all kinds of that. Is that the kind of thing that you guys see with people that you work with?
I don't do that one-on-one, but I sometimes I think, sort of, you know, sex that's predictable in your nice bedroom with your nice cushions and all of those things is not necessarily the most exciting sex. And I think they're complex, these things. It's always about negotiating, isn't it? Where, you know, what are you actually looking for in any encounter? Are you looking to be comfortable and at ease, or are you looking to feel like, you know, really, really turned on and just going for it? I mean, because different scenarios conjure up different things, and there's different forms of good.
Yes.
So I think, it's a difficult question to answer.
It is an extremely difficult question to answer, and to build onto that, sometimes those predictable, less than great sex experiences. So, for example, if you have a long-term partner and For example, with my long-term partner, she just wants to be coddled or touched. That's an intimate experience for her, and she would count that as sex. But to me, that's boring and vanilla. And it's not sex because we're not doing any penetration or we're not touching any genital areas or something. She just wants to be naked and cuddled. And sometimes those different experiences, like you said, are different varies of good. And if it's a long-term relationship, you're building that up. And it's not necessarily maybe what you wanted, but it's not necessarily bad either. To answer to your question, like into those experiences that you seek and ask for and want, that is a really good strategy from the book that you were reading at that time, is to imagine what turns you on, what gets that intuition excited in your belly, and like write that down, write that in a diary or a journal. It doesn't have to stay around very long. You can burn it or something. But just picture it or write it down, and essentially you can work towards that being a sexual goal of yours. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, I guess on the flip side of that, it can sort of seem like everyone around us is having sex, particularly at uni, particularly in your 20s, but there's plenty of people who've never had sex before for, you know, a myriad of reasons. But for someone that hasn't had sex before but is really interested in the world of it, how can they, I guess, navigate or even nurture their own sexual health in that sort of scenario?
There's lots of great influencers out there. This is how I accessed my Masters of Sexology. So I found it through Chantelle Otten, who's a sexologist, and Lauren French is a colleague of mine who I studied with. We both found Chantelle on Instagram, and we were really vibing with the content that she had and how we can put this in our lives. So I would say, as a younger person, getting involved in social media, now also keep in mind with the caveat that you've got to be a critical thinker, and I know all of you would be very good, very digitally literate because you're digital natives. So having that critical thinking cap on and seeing the sexual things, like I was going to introduce some of the sexual influences that I would recommend. So Niamh Mannion, my friend in sex ed, looks at disability and sexuality, and that's a really great place to start because she's worked with all different types of bodies and all different types of people, so she's very accessible resource to get into. Chantal Otten, as I said, and Lauren French, who's a colleague of mine as well. Yeah, I would say, as a younger person, that, yeah. Mm.
Not really, other than to, yeah, just explore, yeah. You know, find out what is out there, what do people do. People do things that, you know, you've never heard of and you couldn't imagine until you stumble upon them, and then you sort of think, oh, well, that's kind of interesting. Maybe that's for me, maybe it's not. But, don't be afraid to explore, but at the same time, make sure you know what it means to be safe in any given space.
Yeah, and I think it might be fun to do a bit of myth busting, because I think there's a lot of faux facts out there when it comes to the world of sex. So, you know, sex and sexual desire are sort of presented in a pretty intense way, often in, like, you know, the steamy Netflix specials or like the spicy romance books. But how does things like desire present in the real world? Is it always that intense?
That's a question. I think that it probably manifests in as many ways as there are individuals, you know, and it'll manifest in different ways for you at different moments. I think the thing is to think about how we deal with those feelings. So don't be overrun by a feeling, although that's, you know, that's not an absolute either, but to think about how we negotiate desire, I guess, is the thing that I would be interested in focusing on.
I would speak to that desire presents exactly as you said, like in a variety of different experiences. And I would say that in film, we do get a variety of different experiences. Like, we do have experiences where you can see that women are not enjoying themselves. Often is that is the case, and majority representation is that we all come at the same time, which is not possible. I kind of advocate that we don't all come at the same time so that we can have focuses on individuals and what people want for their pleasure and what they can get. So, and also referring academically to a desire. I know Dr. Emily Nagotsky, who wrote Come As You Are, which is a fantastic resource. I would highly recommend reading it if you have time. I really enjoyed that. She also has a podcast as well. It's also the same name. She talks about desire as a dual model. So as a desire as a response to a partner initiating, and then desire as you initiating, you wanting. And so it's that dual model of control is talking about desire as like a gas pedal and a brake pedal. So if your partner's foot is on the brake the whole time, but you've got your foot on the accelerator, we're still going to go nowhere in terms of sexual experience, right? We need to release the brake for our partner so that we can both hit that accelerator together at the pace that we want to go. So, yeah, that's another one.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that book as well. So it's, you know, for the people in the room, we do have some copies to give away as well. So, yes, we are very aware of this book.
That was not fair.
No. It's such a great resource. Yes, exactly. And I think one of the things I found super interesting reading that book was when it was talking about arousal. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, whether it's in the romance book or things like that, it is often ascribed to particular physiological responses, but they may not present that way in real life. So what are the different ways that might be able to arousal might be able to show up for people?
Well, I think that there are physiological signs. Mm-hmm. So you get wet, your breathing tends to get faster, your heart tends to beat faster.
Yes.
You probably know more than me.
They are the physiological responses, but most importantly, what I see in my work is the psychological examples. So thinking about sex, or the ways that you want to have sex, or manifesting sex, you know, what I was talking about before, writing it down in your journal, or thinking about what you might like to do with your partner, and then practicing those, asking for those things, either in that relationship or maybe working with your friends to, you know, I really want my partner to lick my clit in circles. So, but I'm really nervous. We've just only started dating. I don't know how to ask for that. We haven't even started any sexual things. Maybe talk to your friends or counselling about how am I going to bring that up? What does that look like? A role play of the experience, I guess. Yeah.
I guess the thing I wanted to say too in regard to things you see on TV, and I mean, I think a lot of sex that you see in the mainstream is actually sex that is not, doesn't have the pleasure of every, you know, all it's participants. Not,
yeah,
it's not pleasure driven often for everybody.
Most of the time it's for cis white men.
It is.
Portrayed
I guess that's
commercial
media.
Yeah.
And I think mainstream porn is a particularly bad place to look for good examples of, you know, healthy sexual encounters.
Absolutely, particularly because the pornographic industry is mainly focused on penetration, and penetration, particularly for AFAB people, so that's people assigned female at birth, is not the ideal to reach an orgasm if that's your goal. I don't encourage you to try for an orgasm the whole time because you will be disappointed. But to have fun in your sexual experiences, and pornography really focuses on that penetration, and that is not successful and arousal for lots and lots of bodies. So, yeah, educating yourself around that and talking, about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess when it comes to testing for STIs as well, I think a lot of people think of it as, you know, they're for a particular group, or maybe for people who are having multiple partners at a time. But is that true when it comes to STI testing?
No, anybody can get an STI if they have unprotected sex once or, you know, 10,000 times. The more times you have unprotected sex, the greater your chances. But, yeah, I mean, what we recommend is that people, if you have unprotected sex, if you get a new partner, then you test, and that you test regularly, basically. A lot of STIs don't show up. You don't get symptoms necessarily quickly, and so in order to take care of your sexual health and make sure that you aren't passing on things to other people, you should test regularly, and it's not something that's shameful.
Absolutely. And to add on to that, protected sex doesn't just look like a condom on a penis. We know that STIs can be acquired anywhere. I've had clients, or just people that I know in the past, friends, that have had STIs show up in their throat, in their mouth, and things like that. So if you're having oral sex, protection is really, any unprotected sex is at more risk.
And so when you say regularly getting tested, would you say, mm-hmm. you know, that's after each new partner or things like that? Mm-hmm. How does that look?
I guess it depends on, yeah, what your sex life looks like. But if you, I mean, we would say every sort of 3 to 6 months, it does depend on a whole lot of other things. So, you know, if you're using condoms, gloves and dental dams all of the time, then probably less so. If you're only having sex with one person who's not having sex with anybody else, if you can know that for sure, you know, that's another scenario. So, yeah, but I would say that if you have unprotected sex, then every 3 months.
Yes.
And I guess what's your advice for someone who might be feeling anxious or even embarrassed about going through that process of getting tested, you know, accessing that sexual health?
I think you're just being responsible if you do that. And people who work in sexual health clinics do not judge. There will be no judgment in those spaces.
I was going to say, your organisation, Thorn Harbour Health, are really proactive, and so are Shine SA. They do not judge you at risk of offending. They don't really care about your test results. They just want you to be a healthy human. So I say, swallow your shame with like a pill, and just go ahead and do it, because it's for your health, it's for your success as human.
We might move into a bit of a Q&A. So we've sort of been had a bit of a presence as Take Note throughout this week for Sextember, and we've been collecting students' questions to sort of answer a few of those. So to kick us off, I guess on the line of STIs, someone's asked, is glandular fever an STI?
That's an interesting one, because I don't think there's any I think some people want to say it is and some people want to say it isn't, because you can get glandular fever without sexual contact, but you can get it through sexual contact, and it is saliva, it's saliva sharing.
Yes.
So I would have said no, but I think some people might say yes.
I'm glad that you gave that nuanced response, because I was just going to be like, no, that doesn't make any sense. So your nuanced response was perfect.
Yeah. The next one is, I've had sex with multiple people in a short frame of time. How can I be safe?
Protected sex. Less riskier sex. So condoms, dental dams, gloves. You can cut a condom if you're having an LGBT experience. Just creating a barrier between you and getting your three-monthly testing at Shine SA and Thorn Harbour Health. That's what would be my recommendation. And have fun. Sounds like you're having fun.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing is it also depends who you're having sex with. So if you're having sex with people who may be HIV positive, then you need to check in with them that they've got an undetectable viral load, in which case they can't pass HIV on. You could take PrEP, which would mean that if you took PrEP every day, it'll stop you becoming HIV positive, even if you have sex with somebody who's HIV positive and they've not got a low viral load. And then there is something else called PEP, where if you think you've had an encounter with somebody who may have been HIV positive, if you get onto a course of PEP within 72 hours of exposure, then the likelihood of that actually becoming HIV is almost zero. So there are a whole range of things to know around HIV. If the person that you're having sex with is HIV positive and they have an undetectable viral load, they cannot pass it on. PrEP doesn't stop you getting STIs though.
So it's only HIV. I have a question of my own because this is your specialty area, Nikki. I'm wondering if there are any side effects of taking PEP or PrEP?
You can't just buy it, so you have to get a prescription. And so there are tests you have to undergo.
Okay.
Because there is the odd person for whom, for some reason or another, it isn't suitable. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, as long as you've been through that process, there aren't side effects.
And that's something that is approachable through Shine SA or Dawn Hub Health?
It is, yep. Okay. So you can go to Adelaide Sexual Health, Shine. You can get PrEP from your doctor, you can get it from the hospital. PEP can be more difficult to get, and we have definitely had people ring us and say, I went to the hospital trying to get PEP from the accident emergency, they didn't know what I was talking about. If people ring us, we'll then ring through to accident and emergency for them and say, look, this is what they need. And we'll do that the same with a regular GP if you need that support as well.
That's such a great thing to know. I think people don't realise how much proactive healthcare is around.
Yeah.
Next question is, can normal warts turn into genital warts?
Regular warts turn into genital warts. Well, the scientific area of study and biology is not my strength, so I am unsure. How do you
I know that. So warts are caused by human papillomavirus. Whether they're common warts, like you get on your hands, plantar warts that you get on your feet, which you might call verrucas, or genital warts, they're all HPV, but there are different strains of HPV. So the ones you get on your hands and feet will never take hold in your genital area and vice versa.
And I guess going on from that, someone else has asked, is it true that once you've had herpes, it never goes away? Which I think is a similar virus.
Yeah, it is. So yeah, HPV doesn't go away, herpes doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can, from my studies in my Masters of Sexology from Curtin University, the basic scientific study, that I have done, I do know that you can get oral herpes on your genitals and genital herpes on your mouth. So making sure that you're having safer sex, because all sex is risky, but we want to promote that safer sex by using those dental dams and those condoms. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Someone else has asked, why does sex in a relationship feel more comfortable than a hookup or a one-night stand?
I don't think that that's necessarily always the case, as Nikki has touched on earlier in the podcast. I think that safe sex is something that you navigate, whether it's just a casual relationship and you only ever see each other once in your life, or whether you have an ongoing, like, terminal relationship, I guess. Mm. Do you have further to add?
Well, I guess I would just add, it's like anything, isn't it? That the more you know somebody, the more you may feel comfortable with them if they are, you know, but you may not. The more you get to know somebody, the less you might feel comfortable with them.
It might be the opposite.
Yeah, I think generally speaking, you would feel more at ease with somebody you knew more. Because you know how to read the signs, whereas with someone you don't know, you're not sure whether you're interpreting their body language or whatever in exactly the right way.
You might just add on to that further, sorry. Mm. I was gonna say, obviously in a relationship, you're seeing each other more in contexts where it's not sexual and you're practicing that trust and comfortableness in situations where you're not having a sexual experience. So when you do move into a sexual experience, you may feel like you are more comfortable. But yeah, that is not always the case. In casual relationships can have comfortability and more trust in them.
And I guess with someone that you know, you're probably more likely to be able to say, oh, I don't like that. Or maybe let's do something else. You might feel more confident in you know, that advocating for yourself again.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Next question. I'm in a long-term relationship and we have sex frequently. Do I still need to get tested?
I would say, I mean, promoting healthy, safer sex, yes, because do you know who your partner is also having sex with? Are you the only person that your partner is having sex with? If you are confident, you are the only person that they are having sex with, but we can never 100% be confident. So I would still promote testing quite regularly, at least, once a year, 3 months.
I think I would say once a year if you're in a monogamous relationship and you're fairly confident that that's what it is. But, you know, there are things that you can pick up that we call STIs that may be picked up in slightly less obvious ways. So, for instance, if you might not be having penetrative sex with somebody, say, but you might be in a sauna and touching somebody and you may contract Mpox, even though you might be in what you understand as a monogamous relationship. I mean, I think that the thing is, once you start unpacking any of these questions, it gets more complex because things are always more complicated than they look. If you're having absolutely nothing to do physically ever with anybody else and neither is your partner, probably don't need to test more than once a year. But I don't think that's probably all that true for a lot of people.
And the last question we've got, someone's asked, is masturbation bad for me?
I hope not.
I was going to say, more people should do it. Yeah, that's how you get to know yourself and your body. And I regret not saying it until this point, is experimenting with yourself and seeing what you do and don't like. Do things to yourself that you think you might like. And if you try it and you hate it, well, you're not going to ask a partner to do it at all. So, mate, please, I'm a huge advocate for self-love and masturbation. So explore your body, do things that you like and do things that you don't like, and practice maybe in your head or with your practice in your head some of the ways that you're going to ask your partner, potential partners, for those things, because then you know you're guaranteed to have a good experience because you've practiced it.
And there are all sorts of fabulous things you can buy.
Yeah, exactly. All the toys
are amazing. Shopping.
Yeah. Does anyone have a Love Hummy link?
Oh, well, thank you so much, guys. That's all the questions we have. We've really, really loved having you both on campus as well as on the podcast. It's been such a joy to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed myself. Thank you for having us.
And for anyone at home, this podcast will also be available as a video on Spotify, and we will be uploading it in a couple of weeks as a regular episode as well, so you can come and revisit. And we'll also have links to lots of resources and anything our guests have mentioned today that we think you might find a bit fun or interesting. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
Take note. This is a UOA On Campus production.